The next day, Valentine sat through a second series of debriefings with Southern Command personnel and civilians whose professional interests include the function and capabilities of the Kurian Order. He was questioned about political conditions of the Legworm tribes and the organization and equipment of the Moondaggers. He even had to give a rough estimate of the population of Kentucky and the Appalachian towns and villages he'd seen. He had to watch his words about the Kurian manipulation of Javelin's COs through a mutt they picked up named Red Dog, the strange doubt and lassitude that temporarily seized even as aggressive a woman as Colonel Bloom, who was back with what was left of Javelin in Kentucky just south of Evansville. It sounded too fantastic to be true, but he did his best to convince them. A researcher from the Miskatonic was particularly interested in the Flying Reaper he'd seen. She had Valentine sort through sketches and photographs. They had one sketch and one blurry, grainy night photo of something that resembled what he'd seen. She had the air of someone used to talking to soldiers who'd seen boogeymen on lonely watches. It was wearying, answering questions from people who weren't interested in his answers unless they fit in with the opinions they'd already had when they sat down in the tube steel office chairs.
You sure it wasn't a gargoyle?
I've seen gargoyles, alive and dead. They're strong and graceful, like a vulture. This was more spindly and awkward. It reminded me of a pelican or a crane taking off. And it wasn't a harpy either. I've seen plenty of those snaggletooths up close.
Yes, I know.
So, do you have a theory?
The Kurians made reapers by modifying human genetic code. They could have done the same thing with a gargoyle.
All very interesting. But Valentine wanted to be back with his command. His last stop on his tour of headquarters was Operations Support. General Lehman had come through with logistics. There was a barge on the Arkansas River being loaded with supplies for his new recruits and to replace the most vital materiel used up in the retreat across Kentucky. Valentine would accompany it back to Kentucky. He picked up mail, pre-sorted for the survivors of Javelin. Valentine wondered what happened to the sad little bundles of letters to dead men and women. The mail had been vacuum-wrapped in plastic to protect it from the elements, but it still took up a lot of room, especially since the locals used all manner of paper for their correspondence. The mail office had a variety of bags and packs for the convenience of ad hoc couriers such as himself, and Valentine just grabbed the biggest shoulder bag he could find. Judging from the waterproof lining and compartments, it might have once been meant to hold diving or snorkel gear. He made a trip to the PX and picked up some odds and ends. Duvalier's favorite talc, a bottle of extra-strength aspirin for Patel, and a couple of 50-count boxes of inexpensive knit gloves. If there was one thing Valentine had learned over the years of commanding men in bad weather, it was that they lost their gloves, especially in action. He liked carrying spares to hand out. Valentine needed peace, quiet, time to think. He caught an electric shuttle and wandered into Jonesboro and found a cafe by the train station, a family-owned grill with three gold stars in the window. He learned from photos and boxed decorations inside that they'd lost two sons and a daughter to the cause. He pleased the owners by ordering eggs accompanied by the biggest steak on the menu, rather than the Southern Command-subsidized pan lunch. The steak was sizable and tough, but his appetite didn't mind, and the cook had worked wonders with the sautéed onions. The young waitress, very young waitress make that, only a teenager would wait tables in heeled sandals, sashayed back and forth with iced tea in one hand and coffee in the other. Whether she was family or no, it would be unseemly to ogle the help under the eye of the mother at the register, watching over her regulars like a hawk, and the muscular father behind the grill. He couldn't think with her friendly pats on the back of his shoulder as she refilled his iced tea, so he paid his bill and left an overlarge tip. The little park in front of the courthouse beckoned, and Valentine was about to take a bench and read his mail when he decided to stop into a small church instead. Valentine thought better on his feet, so he remained standing at the back of the church. Valentine watched the kids for a few minutes. Typical Free Territory youth, no two pairs of jeans matching in color or wear, rail thin and tanned from harvest work or 1,001 odd jobs. You grew up fast here on the borderlands, so different from the smooth, polished, uniformed children of the elite of the Kurian zones, with their new universal church regulation haircuts and backpacks, or the wary ragamuffins of the productives. He shifted his weight from one foot to the other in time to the music, like a tired metronome. Pull out or go all in for Kentucky. Pull out or go all in for Kentucky. Pull out or go all in for Kentucky. Valentine spent an evening enjoying a mock Thanksgiving dinner with William Post and his wife, Gail. She looked strained by Valentine's presence, or perhaps it was the effort involved in cooking a turkey with the sides. Jenny resembled her mother, white-haired and delicate-skinned. Maybe Valentine's imagination was overworked, but she crinkled her eyes just like Post when she smiled. The little three-year-old had two speeds, flank and full stop. She was shy and wary around Valentine, standing in the protective arch of Post's legs, but she ate as though there was a little bear blood in her. The two old shipmates talked long after Valentine cleared the dishes away, Post had sorted and stored the leftovers, and Gail and Jenny went to bed. Valentine told the whole story of Javelin's trek across Kentucky, the sudden betrayal in the Virginia coal country, the Moondaggers, and the strange lassitude of first Colonel Jala and then Cleveland Bloom. He described the victory at Evansville, where the populace had successfully revolted, thinking that deliverance was at hand.
The underground was so used to parsing the Kurian newspapers and bulletins, assuming that the opposite of whatever was being reported was true, that they took all the stories about a defeated army being hounded across Kentucky to mean it was a victorious march along the Ohio. When the Kurians called up whomever they trusted to be in the militia to guard the Moondagger supply lines from the Kentuckians, they acted.
A cold rain started down, leaving Valentine with an excuse to treat himself to a cab ride back to the base's visiting housing. Post asked him to spend the night, but Valentine declined, though the accommodations given a corporal of militia couldn't match up to Post's cozy ranch style. If he spent the night, they'd just be up all the while talking, and he wanted to get back to the logistics and support people about more gear on the alleged barge. The cab showed up after a long delay that Post and Valentine were able to fill with pleasant chit-chat. They shook hands, and Valentine turned up his collar. The cab was a rather claptrap three-wheeled vehicle, a glorified motorbike under a golf cart awning that had an odd tri-seat, a forward-facing one for the driver, and two bucket seats like saddlebags perched just behind. The rear wheels were extended to support the awning and stabilize the vehicle. They reminded Valentine of a child's training wheels. Valentine wished Post had offered him a drink to fortify himself against the cold rain. Another soldier, a corporal, slouched in the seat with his back to Valentine, his backpack on his lap, and clutching the seatbelt white-knuckled as though his life depended on it. Valentine wondered why the other passenger was nervous about a ride you could hop off of a few seconds before an accident.
You don't mind sharing, do you now, Millie?
No, of course not.
Of course you don't. Cheaper for both. You gotta save fuel and rubber. Speaking of rubber, if you've a mind to expend one in service, I know a house.
No thanks.
I'm taking the other corp. It's right on the way.
That explains why he looks so nervous. A bit tired, thanks.
Yeah, suit yourself. It's clean and cheap. Only thing you'll go back to the wife with is a bangover.
A what?
Like a hangover, only your cock's sore instead of your head.
Valentine wondered what percentage the house gave the cabbie. The house was a big old brick foursquare in the older part of town. Most of the houses here were vacant, stripped skeletons with glass and wiring removed, metal taken right down to the door hinges. The one remaining had either been under constant occupancy or been restored. Valentine couldn't tell which in the dark. It had a pair of friendly red-tinted lights illuminating the porch. Candles flickered from behind drawn curtains. Seemed a popular place. A party of four was just leaving. Valentine felt a sharp tug and his windpipe closed up. He realized a rope had been looped around his throat and he was jerked to the ground. He managed a quick look at looming figures framed frostily against the red porch light of the house. They had on ghoulish rubber Halloween masks. The tallest and heaviest kicked him hard in the stomach. Valentine folded in half like a closing bear trap. He opened his mouth to bite, but someone hauled at the rope around his neck, pulling his head away hard.
David Valentine, you murderous, traitorous bastard. Been looking forward to this meeting.
You hauled my little brother all the way across Kentucky to get him killed.
Few more officers like you, and the Kerr won't need no army.
Valentine tried to get his hands up to fight the rope pulling his neck, but two of the attackers closed, each taking an arm above and below the elbow.
All your idea. You and that dumb bitch from headquarters.
Cuff him good, he's slippery.
You've made enemies, Valentine. Now it's time to settle up.
We don't like criminals walking our streets, bold as black.
Grog lover.
Renegade.
Murderer.
You bring any of those red legs into our good clean land, they'll get the same. Be sure of that.
Hell, they'll get hung.
Like you're gonna be. Come on, let's string this fugitive from justice up.
Valentine strained, but the handcuffs on his wrists at his back held firm. The old street in Jonesboro had attractive oaks and elms shading the pedestrians from summer heat. Their thick, spreading boughs made a convenient gibbet above the sidewalk and lane.
Get him on his feet!
The noose hauled Valentine to his feet by his neck. His skin flamed.
String him up!
Valentine knotted the muscles in his neck, fought instinct, kicking as he strangled. The rope wasn't so bad. It was the blood in his eyes that stung. Vaguely, he sensed that something was thumping against his chest. An object had been hung around his neck about the size and weight of a hardcover book. Valentine watched the largest of them wind up. The chunk of broken pavement bounced off his face.
Justice is a dish best served cold.
Let's get the hell out of here.
Valentine spun from the rope end as he kicked. He could barely make out the rope hanging over the branch above him through his foggy red vision. For all their viciousness with boot tips and flung asphalt, they didn't know squat about hanging a man, and he'd purposely kicked with knees bent to give them the illusion that he was farther off the ground than he actually was. He changed the direction of his swing, always aiming toward the trunk of the tree. The rope, which his assailants had just thrown over the thick limb, moved closer to the trunk. He bought another precious 6 inches. 6 inches closer to the trunk. 6 less inches for the rope to extend to the horizontal branch. 6 less inches for the rope to extend to the horizontal branch. 6 inches closer to the ground. With one more swing, he extended his legs as far as they'd go, reaching with his tiptoes, and touched earth. The old sod of Arkansas had never felt more lovely. Valentine balanced precariously on tiptoe and found the energy to give himself more slack. He got the rope between his teeth. Here, the wet didn't aid him, but his blood-smeared teeth managed to thin the rope. Valentine extracted himself from the well-tied noose and slumped against the tree. There was a wooden placard hung around his neck, but he was too tired to read it. Even with the rope, standard Southern Command camp stuff, useful for everything from securing a horse to tying cargo under the hood of a vehicle, removed from his neck, Valentine could still feel the burn of it. He swept his hand through the gutter, picked up some cold, wet leaves, and pressed them to the rope burn. They might come back to check on his body. He had to move. He staggered in the direction of the door of the bordello. He went up the steps to the door on hands and knees. Blood dripped and dotted the dry wood under the porch roof.
He made it! Well, don't just stand there. Let him in.
He had a brief flash of hair and lace and satin before he gave way, collapsing on a coconut coir mat and some kind of fringed runner covering shining hardwood floors.
He's bleeding on the rug. Get some seltzer.
Lord, he's not gonna die on us, is he?
No.
Well, what if they come back to check on him?
They told us not to come out. Didn't say anything about us not letting him in. He made it in under his own power.
They still might do violence even we help him. Toss him in the alley.
Hush up and quit worrying while we got a man bleeding.
I've never refused a gentleman hospitality in my life, and I'm too old to change now. You all can blame me if they do come back. Don't think varmints like that have the guts, though, or they would have watched till he was cold. Alice Ann, iodine and bandages.
Valentine blinked the blood out of his eyes. The women were of a variety of ages and skin hues and tints of hair, mostly blonde or red. He counted six, including what looked like the madam, or maybe she just catered to the certain tastes in experienced flesh. A gaunt old man moved around, pulling down extra shades and closing decorative shutters with a trembling arm. The doorman? He didn't look like he could bounce a Boy Scout from the establishment.
Before you throw me out, could you please get these handcuffs off? If you don't have a key, I'll show you how to do it with a nail.
Are you kidding? In this place? Standard equipment, honey.
The women performed first aid on Valentine at the sink of a small kitchen, one room over from the parlor. He embraced the sting of iodine. It proved he was alive. When he had stopped the flow of blood from face and lip, he looked around the homey kitchen. Baskets of onions and potatoes lined the floor, rows of preserved vegetables filled racks in the kitchen, and bulbs of garlic and twisted ginger root hung from the ceiling, fall's bounty ready for winter. The madam introduced herself as Lady Fair, though whether that was a first name, a last name, a stage name, or a title, she didn't say.
There's a little washroom just off the back door next to the laundry room and past the hanging unmentionables. You just make use of it. There's a flexible shower hose, just the thing for a fast cleanup.
Valentine, feeling a little more human, realized he stank. An unpleasant presence was making itself felt in his underwear. It's not just an expression. They really kicked the shit out of me, Valentine thought. When he came out, a towel around his waist, he glanced into the front parlor and noticed that the porch light had been turned off. A thick head of hair looked through the heavy curtains from the edge of a window. Valentine rubbed his sore neck. The attempted hanging wasn't so bad. It was the pain from the hard jerks from the rope during the fight. He wondered if he had whiplash.
Oh, there you are.
Lady Fair presented him with an old pair of generously cut khaki trousers and some serviceable briefs.
We have a little of just about everything hanging in the basement. You'd think we were a community theater. We do everything but produce Shakespeare.
Surprised you haven't. The bard had his body side.
You just come back now when you're up to it. You seem like a better quality than that rabble, and a smart business is always looking to improve the clientele. Seeing as that disgrace took place right on my front lawn, I'll offer you a freebie when you're feeling more recovered.
I appreciate you taking me into your house.
Oh, it's not my house. We're a limited liability partnership, young man. Quite a few make that mistake, though. I suppose I'm the old lead mayor of the house, though I'm still very much involved on the cash generation side of things. There are some that have learned to appreciate a woman without teeth.
Bordello co-ops. What'll they think of next? Well, then I'm grateful to the whole partnership. Novel idea.
Not really. I'm surprised. Your necktie party insisted you were a fan of professional gentlemen's entertainment. Said you used to visit a place called the Blue Dome. They said it was only fitting that you get hung up on the doorstep of a whorehouse, so to speak.
I don't suppose you could give me their names.
You'll remember we haven't even asked yours.
David will do.
Well, David, if you want names. Nobody gives a real name here. You should really hurry on. Mr. C, our banker and lawyer, is removing the rope from the tree, but if they come back...
Were they Southern Command?
They were in civilian attire, but had fabric belts with those clever little buckles our heroes in uniform wear. One of them was drinking and kept talking about General Martinez and about how things are going to change for the better once he gets in. So I suspect at least some of them were. Oh, and there was this. You want it as evidence?
Lady Fair handed Valentine the placard that had been hung about his neck. It was an ordinary wood bar tray, much ringed and weathered, though carefully cleaned, with black letters burned into it. David Valentine, condemned fugitive, law and order is coming back to the UFR. Whoever had done it hadn't bothered to pencil out the letters or check the spelling before setting to work with the wood burner. Back to the UFR was rather crowded together.
David Valentine. It sounds rather dashing and romantic, as though you should be riding around in a cloak, holding up carriages with a pistol and donating the booty to the peasantry.
I am fond of novels when idling in bed or tub.
Valentine wanted to keep the sign just for the interesting spelling of condemned. Might make an interesting memento on his office door. Maybe they'd summed up his life better than whoever would write his eventual obituary, if he died where people noticed such things. Condemned.
I've troubled you enough. Suppose you've lost a night's business because of this. If you'll let me know what the clothes and bandages cost, I'll come by tomorrow to repay you what I can.
Nonsense. Here's a card. If you do find those rowdies, give us a jingle. We'll give them a little law and order when we point them out in court. Dumb sons of bitches didn't wear those masks when they were in our parlor waiting on you. Just as cheap as they were stupid, too. Kept complaining about not being able to run a tab for their whiskey.
Valentine inspected his reflection in a little mirror on the wall. He'd probably have some horizontal scarring on the right side of his face to balance out the long vertical bullet furrow long since faded on his left. The asphalt had been sharp. Well, he didn't have much keeping him in the United Free Republics anyway. Besides, he had mail to get back to Kentucky. He might as well abandon the guise of a militia corporal. It wasn't doing him any good. He'd return to Kentucky in the leathers of the Bulletproof Clan. Backwater Pete's on the Arkansas River, the third week of November. Pete's is the informal abode of the River Rats, the Brownwater Transportation Flotilla of Southern Command, and the sailors of the quick-hitting, quick-running motorboats of the Skeeter Fleet. Pete himself is long dead, killed during Solon's tenure for theft of Trans-Mississippi Combat Corps property and smuggling supplies to guerrilla bands during the Kurian occupation. His widow followed him to the Reaper Gibbet soon after. Hardly a word had to be changed in the indictment or the sentence. But his brother survived Solon's occupation of Arkansas and rebuilt the old Riverside Bar. Built of ancient gray cypress beams, the color of a January cloud bank, part dockyard, part trading post, part gin mill, and part museum, Backwater Pete's is an institution. A new brownwater sailor who first sees the fireflies of tracer being exchanged at high speed while bouncing down the Mississippi comes to Pete's for his first drink as a real riverman. Newly appointed boat commanders and barge captains fet their crews there, and retiring master mechanics say their farewells beneath the pink and lavender paper lanterns and sensually shaped neon. The bar is decorated with grainy pictures of boat crews, as well as old Sports Illustrated swimsuit models and Playboy centerfolds, immortal icons of wet-haired desire. Wooden models of famous Southern Command river craft, mostly pleasure or sport or fishing boats and tugs, converted to carry machine guns and old rapid-fire 20 and 30 millimeter bush guns, rest on a little brass-railed shelf above the bar. The traditional mirror behind the bar is more of a mosaic of shards now. Having been broken in so many brawls and patched together with colored glass, it now resembles a peacock splattered against a wide chrome bumper. Most newcomers say Pete smells like tobacco, recycled beer, sun-baked sweat, and mud fresh from a swamp where eggs go to die. The regulars wouldn't have it any other way. On that warm night of a quick-fading autumn, the bar saw a stranger. His clothing set him apart immediately. Thick, blue-black leathers that looked too oddly pebbled for cowhide, but not as stiff as snakeskin. He wore a small machine gun pistol in a big soft holster across his midriff, and a straight-bladed, sharkskin-handled sword across his back. Arm braces, like a motorcycle rider might wear, guard his arms, but odd bulges running up from the wrist suggest they might be offensive as well as defensive. For all the weaponry, the high military boots with their lace guards snapped over, the scar descending from his right eye and fresh bruising to the left, and the long black hair tied back so it's out of his eyes, he doesn't look like he's after a fight. For a start, he looks tired. The haggard, leached-out look of a man who has undergone prolonged stress. Then there's the odd hang of his jawline. A humorous tip to his jaw gives him a slight, good-humored smile. The men seated at the bar are dressed in more typical attire of soft white trousers and light canvas jackets, sockless in their rubber-soled boat shoes. They don't make room for the newcomer at the bar, river rats being as fiercely territorial as any dumpster-diving rodents. One of the grizzled river rats nodded towards Valentine.
Cat. Maybe a bear.
What do you think a hunter wants here?
Someone to push up into a length of trouble.
According to Southern Command tradition, Backwater Pete's served the best tequila on chipped ice in the Trans-Mississippi Free Republics. Not being an expert on tequila, Valentine opted for rum and tea, a concoction he'd grown used to during his sojourn in a Korean uniform with the Coastal Marines.
What you drinking, stranger?
Rum.
The drink was of good quality, all the way from Jamaica. Valentine reread his accumulated mail over it, while his mind subconsciously absorbed the rhythms of Backwater Pete's. A man in a bar had the choice to be alone, even if he could smell the sweat and engine oil on the man next to him, and Valentine had dumped his six new companions at a Southern Command billet flop. They were all the reinforcements he was getting, and he didn't like the look of them. Hatchet men, sent to decide what was worth saving and what was worth discarding, plus one young doctor and an ancient nurse. He savored his meal like a gourmet meal. The aches and pains from last week's wounds were forgotten in the excitement of mail. He opened the one all the way from Jamaica first, wondering what tortured route it had taken to get to the UFR. Probably landed by some friendly smugglers on the shore of Texas, probably on the same boat that brought in rum, coffee, and fabric dyes. The Dutchmen from the Southern Caribbean were good about that sort of thing. There was a picture of Amelie, dated 6 months ago and stamped by Southern Command's mails in mid-October, probably on the same boat that made the rum runs. She had deep copper skin and her mother's wide, bright eyes. She would be 7 now. 7. Nice of Melita to write. The letter was mostly of Amelie's doings and development, and included a clipping from the Kingston Current describing the exploits of Jamaica's corsairs off the coast of Cuba. Nothing from Hank in school. Valentine had made a call to make sure he still was in school. He was just getting to be that age where a boy notices all the interesting ways nature arranges for girls to be put together. Molly wrote him as well. He had 3 letters from her, increasingly worried as the months of last summer went by. He found a dry piece of bar and penned her a reassuring reply. There was one more letter to write. It had to be carefully phrased. Narcisse, up in St. Louis, would have to tell Blake that there wouldn't be a visit this year. He'd have to see about sending a Christmas present. It was hard to read, Blake. Valentine still didn't know if Blake had strong feelings about him one way or another. Blake was always interested in new stuff. Was a visit from Papa a break from his usual routine and therefore a source of happiness, or was it more? Valentine shouldn't have been this tired. Maybe he was slowing down with age. He hadn't bounced back from the beating he took outside Lady Fair's little cooperative. Served him right for continuing to wander from office to office and warehouse to warehouse, hunting up help for Kentucky and his old stored gear and their resident ghosts and memories. David Valentine had even had the dubious honor of a trip back to Southern Command's new GHQ at Consul Solon's old executive mansion atop Big Rock Hill to plead Kentucky's case with the outgoing commander-in-chief. One way or another, much of Solon's late model communications gear survived or could be easily repaired, and old Post One didn't lack for office space and conference rooms. The southern half of the hilltop, the old final trenches and dugouts, had filled in and greened over since being churned to mud by big caliber rounds. The consular golf course was back in operation, and the red brick of the former college, a beehive of clerks and radio techs. New giant radio masts had sprouted both on Big Rock Hill. They had stared at his cuts and bruises and listened politely but briefly. A few made noises about thanking him for his efforts in Kentucky. He endured another quick debriefing where he told the same story he told in Jonesboro with the same outcome. It was time to take them back to Kentucky. His efforts in Jonesboro and Little Rock hadn't been completely in vain. They'd given him the Hatchet Man team of replacement NCOs and a shipping manifest of materiel being loaded on a barge, though how Southern Command thought he'd get a barge all the way up the Ohio to Evansville was the sort of detail they had been vague on. When he asked, they said someone was working the problem, and he could meet the barge at Backwater Pete's. The manifest looked promising. Uniforms, or at least fabric to make uniforms, cases of weapons, explosives, even recreational and educational materials for the new recruits. Even more reassuring was the vessel and captain listed on the manifest. Whichever logistics officer they'd put in charge of working the problem knew his or her business. Valentine had last seen the barge tied up on the Arkansas when Consul Solon was still running the Trans-Mississippi from his network of numbered posts. The anchor watch was a rumpled deckhand, rubbing sleep from his eyes.
Permission to book a travel warrant.
Gotta check with the captain.
Captain Mantilla may have changed since Valentine last met him during Solon's brief hold on the Ozarks and Washitas. Valentine's memory of the man had diffused like a re-wetted watercolor. But as the captain approached, Valentine noted the mat of hair and the quick flashing glances that weren't suspicious, just indicative of a busy man with a lot on his mind. Yes, it was him. He stood there in gray overalls, bearing a camouflage of grease stains and a formerly white but now weather-beaten ivory skipper hat riding the back of his head as though bored with the job. Thick-bodied with a bit of a pot, he still looked like a fireplug with a 7-day beard and a couple of arms hanging off it.
Have to ask my passenger. I expect she won't mind.
Passenger? Since when do passengers give orders to captains?
Her charter.
Valentine was shocked to see Dots, Colonel Lambert officially, looking lost in a big patrol coat and a hat with the ear flaps turned down, and fiddling with her dunnage as if deciding what to have handy and what to store below. Valentine wondered if she was traveling not so much incognito as low-key, a simple officer looking for transport, probably on her way to meet a cat and a bear team looking to raise hell in Mississippi.
Sir, I'm told this boat's headed for the Mississippi.
Valentine, not going back already.
Afraid so. Javelin needs these replacements. He'll take priority, of course. I'll go on once he's dropped you downriver.
Lambert cocked her head. Her usual brisk manner was gone. She looked like a traveler who'd missed a bus. Little fissures explored her formerly vital, cheerleader-smooth skin from the corners of her eyes and mouth.
I think we're at cross purposes, Major. I'm joining your command. I'm headed to Evansville as well.
Is there a new operation? I'm not going to get a straight answer on that, am I?
No, I'm joining up with what's left of Javelin. I suppose you haven't heard. My whole command was moved under one of Martinez's staffers. They were going to stick me in an office routing communications where the only decision I'd ever make is what to have for lunch. So, I volunteered to go to Kentucky.
As what? If you don't mind my asking.
I don't mind at all. They need a new full colonel out there to act as CO. No bright young officer wanted the job. Javelin's a dead end as far as Southern Command is concerned. I'm not so sure. Thought I'd be the one to be out there for a change.
Lambert had run a sort of special forces unit dedicated to helping allies in the cause. Kentucky was the second trip she'd sent him on, and whatever had gone wrong in the wooded passes of the Appalachians wasn't her fault.
You've nothing to prove to any of us.
The coffee on this tub's surprisingly good. I think the good captain has connections in every trading port on the river. Let's hit the galley and get some. Tell me more about these quizzling volunteers you recruited.
I have some support staff looking for passage too. And mail, of course.
That bag's a heavy responsibility. If the captain doesn't mind cramming a few more in, I won't object. What do you say, Mantilla?
Fuck it. Cook will be busier as all. I'm fine with it, ma'am. Your people do their own laundry and use their own bedding. I'm not running a cruise ship.
Roger that, Captain.
All you headed up to Evansville?
Looks that way.
Tough run. Not many friends on the Ohio.
Maybe you'll make some new ones.
After some last-minute stores of fresh vegetables came on board, and with no more ceremony than it took to undo mooring lines, the tug pushed the barge downriver into the narrow, dredged channel. Valentine now knew why Mantilla's crew were somnambulist when they tied up. They worked like furies when the boat was in motion, throwing sacks of mail and unloading crates to shore boats along the run practically without stopping, nursing the engines, hosing windblown fall leaves off the decks, cooking and snatching food, and most important, checking depth with a pole on the doubtful river. Mantilla's barge and tug was big for the Arkansas. Most of the river traffic was in long, narrow flatboats with farting little motors that sounded like fishing trawlers compared to the tug's hearty diesels. Valentine, feeling guilty for just watching everyone work, eating of their galley but toiling not for his bread, checked the materiel Southern Command had scraped up for his operation in Kentucky. As usual, the promises on paper didn't live up to what waited in the barge. There was plenty of material for uniforms, soft gray felt in massive industrial rolls.
I know what this is. We took a big textiles plant outside of Houston.
We'll have to sew it ourselves.
It's light, and it keeps you warm even when you're wet. They use it for blankets and liners.
What's it made out of?
Polyester or something like that. Everyone's talking about the winter blankets that Martinez is passing out made of this material, but they're not talking about how he acquired them.
What's the story?
Stuff comes from a fairly high-tech operation, a factory with up-to-date equipment and facilities. We captured it intact outside Houston. The ownership and workers were only too happy to start cranking out material for Southern Command as their new client. General Martinez wouldn't have any of it, though. He had them work triple shifts cranking out fabric, and then when they'd burn through their raw materials, he stamped the whole product property of Southern Command and shipped it north. Factory never got paid, and owner had no money to buy more raw materials, so it's sitting empty now instead of making clothes for Texans and selling uniform liners to Southern Command. But Martinez got close to 1 million square yards of fabric for nothing.
The weapons were painfully familiar to Valentine. The old single-shot lever action rifles he trained on long ago in the labor regiment. They were heavy, clunky, and didn't stand up to repeated firing well. The action tended to heat up and melt the brass casings, jamming the breech. But it was better than nothing, and it threw a big .45 caliber rifle bullet a long way. They'd be handy for deer hunting, if nothing else. The guns kept turning up like bad pennies in his life.
Don't look so downcast, Valentine. Check the ammunition.
Voodoo works.
Pick one up.
Valentine knew something was different instantly. He raised an eyebrow at Lambert.
Yes, it's quickwood. Testing found that the .45 shell was less likely to tumble and fragment. Only a couple of thousand rounds. But if you distribute the Reaper rifles to your good shots...
She didn't have anything to say about the explosives Valentine uncovered next. They'd loaded him up with what was colloquially known as angel food, a vanilla-colored utility explosive that was notoriously tricky to use. The combat engineers used to say working with it kept the angels busy, thus the name. You could handle or burn it without danger, but it was quick to blow when exposed to spark. Even static electricity was dangerous. For preserved food, there was a lot of wham. Probably captured supplies taken off of Quisling military formations and now being repatriated to its native land. The wham had probably logged more time in service than many of his soldiers. As to the training materials, they were mostly workbooks on reading, writing, and arithmetic. Useful to many of the lower-level workers who escaped the Kurian Order functionally illiterate, but not particularly useful to his troops. For entertainment, they had cases and cases of playing cards with the classic depiction of a bicyclist. Inside, the cards were wrapped up like a pack of cigarettes.
Strip poker?
Stakes aren't worth it, not with your face looking like that.
Valentine would have found it hard to put into words to say how relieved he was Lambert was joining them in Kentucky. She was the sort of person who did a good deal without drawing attention to herself. He'd come across an old quote from one of the Prussians, von Moltke something or other, that perfectly described her. Accomplish much, remain in the background, be more than you appear. But had she ever stood under shell fire before? History was full of leaders who were fine organizers, but couldn't face what Abraham Lincoln called the terrible arithmetic of sacrificing some men now to save many in the future. To be honest with himself, Valentine had a little trouble with his sums as well. Later that night, as he had fallen asleep, he felt a slight ominous tickle in his throat. By the time he awoke, it was completely raw and his head was thick with congestion. Mantilla had put them all in oil-stained overalls even dirtier than his crew's and beat up old canvas slippers with strips of rubber sewn in for traction. He liked leaning on the rail, watching the riverbank go by. He observed the increasingly deteriorated standards of civilization along the Arkansas riverbank as the barge drew closer to the Mississippi. Back in the better-served counties with functioning law enforcement, there were polite notices not to tie up or trespass, bought at some hardware store. Farther down the river, you had hand-painted boards up. Keep out. This means you. Or, I'm too cheap for warning shots. Then, closer still to the Mississippi, the ownership left off with writing entirely, and sometimes just nailed up a skull and a pair of crossed femurs at their jetty. They had left the last of the gun position and observation posts guarding the mouth of the Arkansas River at night and turned up the wide Mississippi with all hands alert and on watch. Mantilla's men were experts with paint and brush and stencil and flag, and within a few minutes they had transformed the old barge with Currian running colors. Valentine stood on the bridge, drinking the captain's excellent coffee with Mantilla. They had a shallow draft, so the captain kept close to the Currian east side as part of his masquerade. There were monsters on the river six times as long as Mantilla's little craft.
What kind of dangers are we looking at in this stretch of the river? This is more or less the border between two warring states.
It's sort of a truce at mid-channel. Nobody likes to make a fuss, sinking each other's river traffic. The Sons of Whore's military vessels will chase and shoot right and left, but the coal and grain barges pass without too much trouble. Of course, the Currian captains are smart enough to do a little trade with our little luggers. A few tons of coal or steel given up here and there for a quiet run between the Currian zone and the UFR is a small price to pay. The bastards would rather pay up than fall in the shice with our side.
Chummy.
We stay on our side, they stay on theirs. Most of the time. Your little venture into Kentucky broke the rules. Our Currian friends can't allow that to stand, you know. They'll strike back.
It had better be with something better than what they've used so far. The Moondaggers were vicious, but they weren't much in a stand-up fight against people who could shoot back.
They were supposed to take you quietly into custody. After a few culls, the rest would be exchanged back to the UFR in return for some captured Texas Quislings or some other property the Currians wished not to lose. Your little rebellion in the Ozarks is getting too big for its britches.
Our little rebellion? You're on our side.
Oh, very much so. If I speak strangely, it's only because I know of other rebels in other places and times.
The "and times" comment put Valentine on his guard. How much did he really know about Mantilla? What did the captain's name mean in Spanish again? Was it a cloak or covering of some kind? Valentine wondered how Mantilla, a river captain, knew so much about the fighting. You'd think he'd spend his time studying depth charts and dealing with customs clerks and patrol boat captains. With the usual methodical lucidity he had during illness, Valentine thought the matter over in the glorified closet that served as his cabin. He didn't like being played, but unless Mantilla was an unusually cruel gamester, he didn't think he was being toyed with. Instead, the barge captain seemed to be trying to let him in on a secret without saying so directly. He went to bed wondering just who or what their captain was. If he was, say, a life weaver, why would he be doing something as exposed and dangerous as traveling up and down the rivers of the former United States, and perhaps into the Caribbean and beyond as well? The other possibility was that he was a Currian who had gone over to the side of his estranged relatives, the life weavers, to help the humans, but that made even less sense. There was a third option. Valentine had heard rumors, long ago in his days as a wolf, from his old tent mate, that there was supposed to be another kind of hunter, another caste beyond the wolves, cats, and bears. Of course, it hadn't been much more than rumor. His old tent mate claimed that it was something that life weavers tried to effect in humans, but that didn't work out. They all went mad and were locked up in secrecy. Then again, Valentine had met an old resistance leader in Jamaica who'd been modified in some way by the life weavers. She'd seemed sane enough, even if most of the rumors about her were insane. She'd offered some insight into his future. She turned out to be at least partially right. Valentine didn't know how there could be such a thing as precognition. There were so many variables to life. He'd seen too many lives lost by someone being a step too late or a step too early. He quit thinking about Mantilla. As long as he got them safely to Evansville, or to the mouth of the Tennessee and Kentucky even, past Paducah.
What the hell?
The familiar crack put Valentine atop Big Rock Hill and running through the kettles of South Central Wisconsin and in the dust of the dry Caribbean coast of Santo Domingo, and with the Punishment Brigade on the edge of the minefields around Seattle, not sure of which and remembering each all at once in dizzy, sick shock. Then he remembered Lambert had told him that Mantilla had said she could practice with her rifle up by Missouri Boot Heel territory. He put on his boots, grabbed a piece of toast, and went up on deck to watch. Lambert, dressed in some washed-out, sun-bleached fatigues, was in the seated position, looking down the scope through a scratched and hot-glued pair of safety goggles. Valentine had seen the rifle's cheap cloth case when he came aboard and wondered what she had in there. He recognized the weapon. It was one of the Atlanta Gunworks Type 3s he'd become familiar with when Consul Solon had issued them to his ad hoc group posing as quislings on the banks of the Arkansas. They were sought-after guns in Southern Command, basically an updated version of the old United States M14. Lambert looked like she'd had one rigged out for special operations. It had a slightly longer barrel with a flash suppressor and a fine-looking optical scope, as well as a bipod that could fold down into a front hand grip. The plastic stock had a nice little compartment for maintenance tools and a bayonet wire cutter. The bayonet was a handy device. It had a claw on the handle that was useful for extracting nails, and the blade was useful for opening cans or creating an emergency tap in a keg. But he knew the weight and length of the weapon all too well. Lambert, for all her determination, found it an awkwardly big weapon to handle. She was using it to pepper pieces of driftwood, old channel markers, and washed up debris lining the riverbank.
You're a good shot.
It's hard to be a bad one with this thing. I wish it wasn't so goddamn heavy is all.
Try mine.
Valentine offered her his submachine gun. It was a lethal little buzzsaw with an interesting sloped design that fought barrel rise on full automatic fire. Perfect for someone Lambert's size. He'd carried it across Kentucky and back. Valentine looked at the serial number on Lambert's gun. Something about the stock struck him as familiar. An extra layer of leather had been wrapped around the stock for a better fit on a big man. He'd last seen this gun outside Dallas.
This belonged to Moira Stiakowski.
Yes.
She gave you her old number 3?
No. Colonel Post gave it to me. I wanted his advice on a good field rifle. He said something about Kentuckians knowing a good long rifle for 300 years and counting. And if I got desperate, I could probably trade it for a working truck. Optics being precious in the borderlands. I'm thinking about trading it, though. It's a great heavy thing.
Post knew his guns. Odd of him to give Lambert too much gun. He'd made a present to Valentine of his first .45 caliber automatic. Valentine had lost it, of course, but had replaced it with a similar version at the first opportunity.
That's more my size.
Valentine considered a lewd comment about a small size having its advantages in ease of handling, but decided against it. Lambert wasn't a flirt, and had been his superior too long for it to feel right, even as a joke.
May I?
Be my guest.
The number 3 wasn't quite as handy as the Steyr Scout Valentine had gone west with, but the optics were better, and it had another 100 meters on the carbine. It was a weapon that could serve equally well as a sniper rifle and a battle rifle. Valentine wouldn't care to use it for house-to-house street fighting, but for the woods and hills of Kentucky, it was ideal.
Want to switch permanently? I'd love to get my hands on an old number 3.
Will said to sleep with it or you'd steal it.
Unless it has sentimental...
I'm teasing, Valentine. Will said I should trade it if I found something better. I like your gun more. But are you willing to...
Only if I'm not breaking up a love triangle between you two and the rifle.
I think he'd be pleased as anything if you carried it. He thinks you hang the moon, you know.
Only by standing on his shoulders. While he bled. Ever fired a gun in battle?
During Archangel. I don't know if it counts. Our column came under fire at night. I bailed out and started blasting away at the gun flashes with everyone else. Turned out we were shooting at our own men. No one was killed, but 2 of our men ended up in the hospital.
It happens.
Post said that when you were young, you lost someone close by accident like that.
True.
I'm sorry. Was he not supposed to talk about it? He only told me to make me feel better about that night.
I didn't know you two were that close.
Oh, I might as well tell you. I facilitated his adoption of Moira's daughter after her plane went down. Facilitated isn't quite the word. Stole, maybe. She was supposed to go to that special school where they're bringing up transhuman children.
Transhuman?
It's just an official designation for people enhanced by the Life Weavers. You never ran into it?
I've been out of the communication loop for a while now.
Of course.
Well, it's better than subhuman. I met a few civilians who'd use that word. When did Stiakowski and Post get so close? During the fight at Big Rock Hill?
You mean Valentine's Stand?
History books don't call it that.
She knew him from that, obviously. She met him again when he was assigned to the assessment staff. He gave a very thorough report, and Moira said she had a thing for the older, fatherly-looking guys. I was a little surprised. She never said anything about an interest. Well, that's neither here nor there. But I understand the appeal. He is good-looking. I got to know Post better through her. He told me some interesting details about life in camp with General Martinez, by the way. He knew Moira and I had been close, and he said he wanted me to have her gun the last time we... the last time we met.
Valentine didn't know the extent of Post's injuries that confined him to his chair. Didn't know how his marriage had been put back together or under what terms. None of his business. Lambert was blushing. Valentine couldn't ever remember seeing her blush before.
Does Gail know about Will's connection with Jenny's real mother?
No. Moira said they ended it after you brought Gail back. It took them a while to figure out who each of them was and who the other one was in the marriage. Will told me Gail had changed a lot out there through her experiences. But he was determined to take care of her.
Who's Jenny's father?
Moira said it was a man she met after the Razors broke up.
None of my business. I wonder if Jenny's got a little bear in her. Some of the bears get very randy after a fight.
I've heard that.
Whatever Moira had in her blood might have been passed to her daughter.
But bear parents don't always pass on their tendencies, I'm told. Sometimes the kid's just a little feistier than most, or heals bumps and bruises faster. Also, she's a girl. Don't female bear fetuses miscarry?
I was told that it's adult women who tend to have heart attacks or strokes when the Life Weavers try to turn them bear. I don't know about the children.
Southern Command is still doing that breeding program, because there are so few Life Weavers.
I haven't spoken to one in ages.
Knowingly, anyway. They're operating in secret these days with so many Kurian agents around.
Boat trips leave you a lot of time to think. As Valentine played with his new rifle's butt and balance, trying to decide if he should add another inch to the butt, he thought about his friend. Old Will. Well, not that old. He had a decade on Valentine at most, whatever his personnel file said. In the Kurian zone, you always falsified your birth date whenever you had the chance. Valentine pictured Stiakowski running her quick fingers through Post's salt and pepper hair. So there was some hot blood beneath that cool countenance.
Damn.
Now, Tia warned us about this. He said to head down to the engine room if we're approached.
I say we head up top, just in case there's a problem.
Roger that.
Valentine wished there was time to go forward into the cargo barge and get some of the explosives. No time. Valentine took a look at the patrol boat. He didn't see the usual blue-white streamer of the Mississippi's River Patrol, so he suspected it was from one of the Kurian towns. Maybe they were in search of bribes. But the craft had official-looking lights. It was a low, boxy craft, and looked like it had a crew of three, sort of a brown-water tow truck. He had a height advantage from the cabin deck. The patrol craft suddenly sprouted a machine gun from its roof. The barrel turned to cover the bridge. Valentine tipped a bunk and shoved it against the porthole wall. He didn't do anything as stupid as shoving the barrel out the window. He just kept watch. Valentine watched as lines were passed between the two boats. Valentine, flattening himself against the wall beside the porthole, observed two men and a dog come on board. The senior officer, judging from the stars on his shoulders, kept his hand on his pistol as he came aboard. He had a squinty, suspicious look about him, like an old storekeeper watching kids pick over candy tubs. Captain Mantilla came down to greet them. The older of the two men looked shocked, perhaps at the captain's slovenly appearance. Suddenly, the officer threw out his arms and embraced Mantilla like a long-lost brother. Valentine couldn't understand it, but it seemed like the crisis had passed. He watched the search team go forward. He wrapped the gun in a blanket and stowed it and his ammunition vest. He didn't need to change clothes. Like the rest of the passengers, he'd been wearing crew overalls so he could move around on deck freely without drawing attention from the riverbank. Curious, he went out to the rail on the port side and watched Mantilla with the search team. They were doing a good deal of animated talking and very little searching. Even the dog looked bored and relaxed, sitting and gazing up at the humans, panting. The patrolman debarked. Valentine waited for the inevitable bribe to pass down to the senior officer, but a square bottle full of amber-colored liquor passed up to Mantilla instead. As it turned out, they were boarded from the other side of the river, an hour's slow progress from where they had met the patrol boat. Valentine saw some soldiers, probably out of rally base, signal with a portable electric lantern and wave them in. Two men stood along the railing of the patrol boat. One was a big muscular fellow who had the look of a river drifter that had made a little spare money watching for enemy activity. The other was a magazine cover of a man with slick-back hair.
Permission to come aboard, Captain?
Granted.
The muscular man tossed over a big military-issue duffel. On closer inspection, Valentine saw that the would-be passenger had a pencil-thin mustache precisely trimmed to the edges of his mouth, which was smiling at the moment.
Good God! I was afraid I'd missed you. My river rat swore to me that your tug had passed yesterday. I thought a very bumpy ride had been in vain. Broke records getting to rally base. Transport warrant, letter of introduction, and permission to be on Southern Command military property. That's the lot. I was hoping to hitch a ride.
This trip is chartered by Colonel Lambert. You'll have to ask her.
Who are you?
Rollaway Bolnitz, but my friends call me Pencil. I'm a freelancer with the Bulletin. My specialty is actually Missouri, but I'm eager to learn about Kentucky.
The Bulletin was a minor paper published near the skeleton of the old Walmart complex in Arkansas. It was new, post-Archangel and the UFR anyway. Valentine had never read it.
Why Pencil, Mr. Bolnitz? Because of the mustache?
No. At school, I always lost my pencil and had to borrow. It just stuck.
Well, Valentine, you wanted reinforcements. One pen a mighty army makes.
General Lehman suggested I join you. I was talking to him to get a retrospective on his tenure. He said a bit of publicity might help your cause in Kentucky and the cause on top of it.
That's Lehman's signature, all right. The permission to be on Southern Command property might have been overkill. Kentucky's neither fish nor fowl at the moment.
You know what you're getting yourself into, Bolnitz? There's no regular mails between Kentucky and the UFR. No banks to cash expense vouchers.
I was hoping for the traditional hospitality of Southern Command to members of the press. As to my stories, one of your men can transmit via radio. General Lehman said you are in radio contact twice daily.
That settled any issue about this being a put-up job. Radio security was about as tight as Southern Command could make it, involving scramblers and rotating frequencies. Lehman must have passed that tidbit on. Standard Southern Command procedure for brigades in the field was 3 radio checks a day. As theirs had to be relayed through rally base, they found it easier to do just 2. Valentine shrugged and gave Lambert a hint of a nod.
Welcome aboard, Pencil. I hope you find the situation in Kentucky interesting.
But not too interesting. We've all had enough interesting this summer to last us till pension draw.
Bolnitz shook hands all around. It was hard to say which version of Pencil Bolnitz was more handsome. Serious, expletive Bolnitz, or grinning, eager-to-befriend Bolnitz. Valentine couldn't tell whether Lambert had a preference either. The bottle their patrol boat had given them contained some 7-year-old bourbon. Mantilla shared a glass with Valentine that night. They sat in the captain's day cabin. Valentine supposed it was meant to be an office, too, but the ship's records seemed to take up one thick sheaf of paper in various sizes, stains, and colors attached to a rusty clipboard. A single bulb cast yellow light on the cabin deal table. Mantilla and Valentine sat with their legs projecting out into the center of the cabin as the captain poured.
This should help clear you out, Valentine.
Makes being sick a little more relaxing. The inspection today, what was that about?
Well, formality, as it turned out.
Thought you said you didn't know the boat.
I didn't, but I turned out to be an old friend of the officer in command of the patrol boat.
Were you?
For a little while. Today, anyway.
I thought you hadn't met him before.
I never saw his face in the whole of my life. And you would remember a face like that. Like an asshole with pimples.
What does that mean?
Oh, you know how a shitty bunghole seems like it's winking at you.
No, you never met him, but he knew you.
Major Valentine, let's just say that I'm an expert in letting people see what they want to see. Let me tell you a secret about people, Valentine. They're really good at fooling themselves. They go through life jerking themselves off, complimenting themselves that they're seeing things as they are. Really, it's wishing, like a little boy on a skateboard pretending it's a jet airplane. Some chocha says, no, 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 but the prick she's with hears, yes, yes, yes.
Or she's hearing wedding bells and he's thinking bed springs. But I don't see how that gets a sealed bottle of bourbon out of a local river cup.
He didn't want to come on board and find trouble. He was hoping for a friendly face, and I gave him one.
Just how did you do that?
Allow me to keep a few secrets, Major. I will say this. All it takes is the tiniest bit of a nudge. A shape in the shadows turns into an old friend. A crumpled old diner check turns into a valuable bill. An old spreadsheet becomes a transport warrant.
Sounds like magic.
With magic, people are looking for the trick that is fooling them. What I do is give them a little help fooling themselves.
Go on.
Okay. You're walking down a dark street and you hear someone following. Merde! When you turn around, would you rather see a policeman or, better yet, your neighbor following behind? But of course, as you turn, you hope, you pray, it is not a thug or worse. Those men on the river, even the patrols, they do not want trouble. They like to meet bargemen they know, friends who bring the good sweet liquors of Mexico and Curacao, gold even, or silks from the Pacific Rim and Brazil that they have obtained in New Orleans.
Was Mantilla presenting Valentine with what he wanted to see? Did he want to see an unkempt, out-of-shape boatman with a sweat-yellowed cap and grease stains on his knees and chest? Valentine supposed he did. Older, weathered, an experienced man who'd lived long on the river and attended to his engines even at the cost of some mess, Mantilla had Valentine's respect. Even a little flab added to the secure image. Mantilla enjoyed his food. Then there was the keen, roving eye from the face Mantilla never quite turned directly toward you. Canny, with part of his mind on you, part of it on ship or river or weather.
Handy trick. I don't suppose you could teach me the knack.
When you work up the guts to look into your own mind and come to terms with what's living there, then you can come to me and speak of venturing into others' minds.